Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Hassan. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, in Nelson, BC, a planned storytime event featuring a drag artist faces a barrage of online outrage and threats. The library was forced to cancel the event.
You can't run and hide from that kind of negativity and that kind of hate. And I wish so much that nobody ever had to deal with the things that we have to deal with.
And three stories coming out of Ontario. A Six Nations farmer is on a mission to ensure that traditional Haudenosaunee farming techniques are passed on to the next generation.
Food sovereignty, food security, all these issues, climate change, none of them will be solved if we don't have a collective mind.
The Six Nations elected council is wondering why it was not included in the First Nations drinking water settlement.
That indicates to me that there's ignorance on the side of the government because they don't know the true factors of the water situation on all First Nations.
And Martha's Table, one of Kingston's community centers, is planning on expanding its services to the unhoused and people in need.
You know that you're working towards something that's going to have such a positive impact. People are struggling and it's rough.
These stories and more on Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for being with us. A library in Nelson, British Columbia was forced to cancel a drag queen storytelling event following threats. The Nelson Public Library also closed its comment section on its Facebook page. The planned storytime featuring a drag artist faced a barrage of online outrage and threats against the library. Berkeley Volks, a Nelson-based drag performer, said he was contacted by a Nelson Library staff member informing him that the event would not go forward after it received threats from groups in Castlegar and Salmo. Nelson Public Library Chief Librarian Tracy Thirien did not return our journalist's request for comment, nor did a library board representative. Several similar instances of disruption or threats against drag storytime events at public venues have been noted across North America in recent years. Last October, a drag event in Oregon drew protesters armed with assault rifles who opposed the event. John Roon is in Nelson, British Columbia. He's following that story for us.
On Tuesday morning, local performer Berkeley Volks was still preparing for Saturday's drag queen storytelling event at the Nelson Public Library when he got a telephone call from a staff member telling him the plans were off.
I was informed this morning that the library has had way too many threats and they don't feel comfortable, and I respect them. They have done amazing things.
The library, concerned over threats made against the event, told Volks they would be canceling what was supposed to be a day of family-friendly entertainment, but which has received a barrage of online backlash and hateful comments in the last week, accusing the library of putting on an inappropriate and sexually charged event geared against children. Berkeley Volks planned reading for the day, a kid's book about two foxes.
So there's no gender, there's no sex, there's no anything about any of that. It was about loving that tiny human or that tiny creature, no matter what.
The online outrage contained calls to action against the event, such as flooding the Nelson Library right at opening time to disrupt the story time from happening. It appears to have been fueled by a video by a woman describing herself as a local concerned mother who falsely claims the event is breaking the criminal code. The same rhetoric has been noted across North America, where protesters have been disrupting similar events in public venues. Just months ago, prompted a group of armed protesters to show up to another drag time story event in Oregon, stating they were there to protect the children from sexual predators, an accusation which was also directed at Saturday's event in Nelson. Berkeley Volks says the event was supposed to be safe, family-friendly, and that he was planning to dress up as a cowboy for the day.
I was just going to do something light and fun, something that kids could kind of look at, almost as if you were a clown that made it was safe. There was nothing crazy about it. I was thinking about being a cowboy for the morning, and yeehaw and whatever, dressing up like that.
On Tuesday, Nelson Library staff did not want to talk, and neither did the library board, but they handed out a pamphlet stating they had postponed the event to make sure patrons would not confuse it with other regularly scheduled storytelling hours. Meanwhile, Vaux, a transgender man who recently returned back to the Kootenays to raise his family, is wondering what has happened to the tolerant hippie town he left behind.
I left to see what life looked like outside of the Kootenays, and I moved back because I lived in some big cities and I didn't want my kids being raised in that kind of hateful atmosphere, and I thought the Kootenays would be the safest place for them, and it turns out you can't run and hide from that kind of negativity and that kind of hate. And I wish so much that nobody ever had to deal with the things that we have to deal with.
Reporting in Nelson, John Roon.
You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
To Ontario, where Six Nations elected council is continuing its work to be included as an impacted First Nation in the First Nations drinking water settlement. The settlement's application deadline has been extended to March 7, 2024. The settlement allows certain First Nations and their members who are subject to a drinking water advisory to seek a compensation. Six Nations is currently not identified as an impacted First Nation. Six Nations Councillor Hazel Johnson questioned why the community had not been included as an impacted First Nation from the beginning of the lawsuit and said it indicates ignorance on the government side. Details with Andrew Dow in Oshawa, Ontario.
The First Nations drinking water settlement application deadline has been extended until March 7, 2024. During the February 28th General Council meeting, JFK Law representatives Robert Janes and Laura Edwards spoke with Six Nations elected council on the water settlement and next steps for community members. Six Nations is currently not listed as an impacted First Nation, but has applied for its members to be included in that list to seek compensation. Robert Janes detailed the class action settlement and talked the timeline of seeking compensation and other options if Six Nations is not accepted as an impacted First Nation.
But I think to add to it, what's happened since then is that the action was started as a class action. So it was brought by one nation, potentially on behalf of a wide range of nations. And then subsequently, there was a settlement agreement that was led by the government of Canada and a couple of the nations that were in charge of the class action. And now we're at the point where each nation in Canada has to determine if they want to be part of the class action. And then there is a process for determining if they're eligible to be in the class action. And with the essential idea being that if you're in the class action, you get whatever the class action promises. And if you're not in the class action, then there's more limited rights, but you can still pursue another lawsuit.
Janes also spoke on the significance for the particular dates set out in the class action settlement for individuals seeking compensation.
But part of the reason for those particular dates is because those represent what's called the limitation period. So normally claims can only go back so far. And so essentially that is from the date that the claim was decided to a certain number of years back. And essentially the number of years back reflects the view that that they wouldn't be able to claim damages for further back than that.
Rod Whitlow, Six Nations environmental lead, stated he has worked to locate archived documents stating Six Nations and its residents were under a boil water advisory during the stated claims period.
We have looked at all of the documentation in the archives and in the records, and we've even pulled out some archived media articles from the local newspapers. So we have determined as far back as the year 2000, the then chief, Dave General, did mention the boil water advisory for the community, and he had indicated that it had been actually in place. I think he said for many years. I think it even goes back. So it actually predates the claim start period of 1995. So that's at a general level what we kind of been how we've been responding to community inquiries, the boil water advisory at a high level, generic level, for the whole community has existed for the entire claim period, with a notation that it is on each individual household to determine if they've had additional documentation or different advisories issued by Health Canada or Indigenous Service Canada, whether it was the late Paul Strohack or Peter Hill, to say, do not drink the water. So there's different, in the settlement agreement, there's actually different degrees of compensation, whether it was a boil water advisory or a drinking water advisory, or even do not use.
Laura Edwards was able to detail what documents could help applicants be accepted and stated the 2000 News article from former Six Nations Chief Dave General would help, but boil water advisories from Health Canada, Six Nations Health Authority, or the Public Health Authority for Ontario would be more beneficial.
If the claims administrator initially decides not to add Six Nations onto that list of impacted First Nations, there is a, I believe, 60-day period of time where you can submit more documents to show that you should be on that list. And certainly that letter would help, but the most helpful things are any sort of drinking water advisory, whether that is a letter from Health Canada advising individuals not to consume, and many of those over a few years, or the Six Nations Health Authority or the Public Health Authority for Ontario, giving out those advisories and having more than one so you can show that they've lasted for more than 1 year.
Janes went into further detail, stating the chances of Six Nations individuals being approved for compensation if Six Nations is left off the impacted First Nations list would be doubtful.
If the nation doesn't get approved, it's pretty unlikely that they'll approve individuals based on sort of similar evidence. Like, really, the whole advantage of the nation applying is that if the nation's in, then the members are in, and the members don't have to go through the process of individually trying to convince the administrator. But if for some reason the nation can't get across the line, then it's going to be pretty hard for individuals to do it, because really the kind of thing they're looking for are those documents that Laura described, those more official documents they can point to saying, you know, here's a public authority who did tests and ordered a boil water advisory or something like that.
Councillor Hazel Johnson questioned why Six Nations was left off the list to begin with.
That indicates to me that there's ignorance on the side of the government, because they don't know the true factors of the water situation on all First Nations, because everybody had their water through a well. Mm-hmm. Nobody had running water for quite a while. And if they're comparing to residential areas off reserve, yeah, they all had running water, but we didn't.
Yep.
In my own personal situation, we've had two wells, one dug and one drilled, and a cistern. And every one of those were condemned because they were not, it was not good water. Mm-hmm. So for so long, we've had to buy water. And not only that, if you ask a number of First Nations people on this reserve, who all has those, buys that water, like the water for the coolers, like the drinking water, simply because you had to become accustomed to not drinking that water. So now it's just an automatic thing. Everybody goes and buys that water, puts it on a cooler, and that's their drinking water for the household.
Rod Whitlow said that Six Nations has been under a boil water advisory since the end of the claims period and will never be off the advisory until all members of the nation are no longer using wells and everyone is connected to the drinking water distribution center.
So if you think about it, so if that's the government's end goal is to get all the northern remote First Nations off of boil water advisory, they intend to do that by giving them enough resources so that their water treatment plant is operating to provincial standards and that their water treatment plant operators are fully qualified. We're never going to be in that situation here at Six Nations until every single well is abandoned and we're all connected to the drinking water distribution system community-wide. Or in the interim, if that's not going to happen, then we're each going to have a cistern, because all of these engineering reports that have come out over the years about the quality of the groundwater here at Six Nations, it's just not, it cannot be used without proper treatment. So that we're always going to be at a disadvantage. So people say, well, the boil water advisory is actually still in effect. Yes, indeed. Since June 20th, 2021, the end of the claim period to the present day, you should not be drinking any water from any well, whether it's drilled or dug, without proper treatment.
Six Nations elected council say they are currently working on connecting with the community to hold a Q&A session to provide further information on the First Nations drinking water settlement.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints. Check out our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Before we go to David Moses in Oshawakin, a feel-good story coming out of Kingston, Ontario. People helping people is always comforting. Martha's Table, one of Kingston's community centers, provides nutritious meals to the unhoused and people in need. Martha's Table had to reduce their services during COVID-19, but hopes to open up soon again to serve three meals a day to those in need as soon as resources allow. But things are looking up. Martha's Table has recently purchased the adjacent property of the building it's currently in. The building is a historical one, and until it can afford the major renovation it needs, Martha's Table transformed it into a warming center that provides coffee and tea. Alexandra Fernandez is in Kingston, Ontario. She met up with Martha's Table Executive Director Rhonda Candy to talk about the purchase of the new property and what Martha's Table projects are for the next year.
Today in our studio with me, I have Rhonda Candy, the Executive Director of Martha's Table, here to chat with us about Martha's Table, what the organization does, as well as some new projects that the organization is working on. So thank you so much for joining me in studio today, Rhonda. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here. I'm excited to share with the community what we're doing here at Martha's Table.
Yes, and I'm very excited to hear more about it. So what is Martha's Table? What's sort of your mission and what sort of resources and services do you provide for the Kingston community?
Okay. Martha's Table is a community meal program. So for anyone that finds themselves in need, they're welcome to come to Martha's and pick up a fully prepared meal. And pre-pandemic and soon, we will have indoor service where people can relax in a warm or a cool setting, an environment that is welcoming and safe, and really they can recharge and relax, make plans, make connections to other agencies. So it's a really a full community program.
Martha's Table has recently bought the property attached to where you currently reside as an organization, which has opened up as an emergency warming center. Can you tell us a little bit about starting this warming center?
You know, it's been years in planning. Mm-hmm. We have... Pre-pandemic, we were at capacity, so we knew we needed to expand, but mm-hmm. we weren't sure how to do it. We have to, you know, be smart and strategic, find the right location. And, you know, the right location was exactly where we were when the property became came on the market. After much deliberation and planning, we decided to purchase it. So the property needs so much work and so many renovations, but we have it, and it's the middle of winter. There's no way we weren't going to open the doors so mm-hmm. people could come in, get out of the cold, and maybe enjoy just a coffee or a tea, and then on their way. We hope in the spring that we'll be able to do a lot more of our renovations and have a bigger space for people to enjoy,
yeah.
you know, with maybe small tables and chairs that they can sit at. And short-term goals would be to have breakfast and lunch mm-hmm. Indoors as an option, and longer-term goals, maybe towards the end of the year, maybe a sit-down evening dinner as well. So three meals a day is something we did pre-pandemic. During the shutdowns and all the changes everybody had to live with, we had one meal a day. So this is really exciting to us, and we know how important the social connection is, people having a place to go, to meet with friends, to socialize, and that was lacking. I know so many people that use Martha's Table are looking forward to it. It's really exciting, but rewarding is part of the experience as well, that you know that you're working towards something that's going to have such a positive impact.
And what was the pandemic sort of like for Martha's Table? You know, definitely mm-hmm. unfortunate to, yes, drop down to only the one meal a day. There was a big increase in the amount of houseless people here in Kingston. Kingston's vacancy rate has dropped yet again. So what sort of like did the pandemic highlight, and not necessarily in a positive way, but what did it sort of highlight in our community with the amount, in regards to the amount of people accessing places like Martha's Table or even like other places too around the city? What was that like?
We always knew there were challenges, but even for us at the front line, we were almost scrambling to meet the demand. As you mentioned, the number of people that are unhoused has unofficial reports. It's tripled since the pandemic. We also started delivering meals door to door to people that couldn't leave home.
Oh, wow.
So that was another area of outreach as we recognize as a dramatic need during the pandemic. And we'll continue it moving onward because we've seen the impact that it's made. So the number of people that are struggling has increased. And I mentioned social isolation. We've seen people spiraling and not in a good way from lack of contact and lack of access to resources. So, I mean, for a long time, this is very basic, but there weren't public bathrooms for people to access. So, you know, from the basic human needs all the way up, it's been quite a dramatic change the pandemic has brought to our city and to cities all around. People are struggling and it's rough.
What can people do, you know, if they are privileged enough to be able to help support Martha's Table or just like food banks, warming centers, shelters in general? What can people do? How can people help?
That's a great question. The community has been so supportive. Kingstonians are awesome. And at Martha's Table, we don't get government funding, so we rely completely on the community. And I know there's other agencies in a similar position. So if you're able to share, you know, you might say to yourself, well, I only have, you know, $5 or a smaller amount. Every dollar helps. Mm-hmm. And at Martha's, we spend them with that in mind, that every dollar is hard earned and we respect that and we try to stretch it as far as possible. You can also volunteer your time. So come in and offer, you know, 3 hours one day a week. And that's something that will benefit the entire community. There's a lot of opportunity to take part and have an active role in helping people. Spreading the word, that's another way you can help that costs nothing, your time or your funding. Just tell friends, hey, did you hear about Martha's Table? They've expanded. Or did you hear about St. Vincent de Paul? They're expanding. Whatever the need might be, just you can share that with your community, whether it's through social media or in person. We never know what those connections will ripple out into. Communities need to work together. My favorite phrase, maybe overused, is it takes a village. Mm-hmm. And this is part of how we get this done. So thank you to everyone here and to the community for their ongoing support. We've been doing this since 1997. So that's a lot of people helping other people.
We were just listening to Martha's Table Executive Director, Rhonda Candy, speaking with journalist Alexandra Fernandez.
Hi, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
And as promised, we close off the show in Six Nations, where farmer and ex-teacher Terilyn Brandt is on a mission. She's helping out a Six Nations Young Farmers Collective by teaching them how to grow and use food using traditional Haudenosaunee ways of farming, and she does so on her own land. The group members between 20 and 35 years old have different levels of farm development. Brandt launched the collective last fall. After reflecting on her life, she had time to think about her uncle's belief that his life was for nothing if the younger generations were not continuing to farm traditionally. In the Young Farmers Collective, the youth have to show they are committed and want to be part of a 3-year collective process. Journalist David Moses met up with Terilyn Brandt in Oshawa, Ontario.
Former educator Terilyn Brandt describes herself as an old-time farmer. What she means is that she employs traditional Haudenosaunee ways of farming on her Six Nations land. It's something that she now passes down to a collective of young farmers in the community. But it was a few personal challenges that gave her the idea, such as her recent successful quadruple bypass.
I had a serious operation. I had a quadruple bypass. So I was out of sync for like 11 weeks. And when you're laying there in bed, you're like, oh, man. You know, I did. And then again, the thoughts of my uncle came back. He said, my life was for nothing. Mm. You know, because when he said, I can't turn around and my generations aren't doing things the way they should be doing them, right? And when he said, not all of them, but there was a few, right? And so I got thinking about that, and I thought, I have literally taught and done agricultural workshops of all kinds everywhere and literally taught hundreds and hundreds of people, right, in these workshops. And so I got thinking, I thought, you know what? Our big issue is that we just got to do it.
Brandt's uncle also played another role in her life when she needed her house built. Although she had the materials, she was lacking the funds to pay for building it. So her uncle encouraged family members to help build her home, and Brandt only had to pay for the food and beverages.
That experience led me kind of to reflect upon your life and what things happened and what things impressed you. So that led me to operating with the young farmers in a collective sense.
She says that with her house being built the way we always used to help each other, it led to her reaching out to the youth.
So I gathered them up and I invited them and I said, I'm inviting you to a young farmers collective. And the reason I'm calling it collective is because it's a key vital ingredient in not only our own history, our own way of agriculture, but it's critical in the survival of our nations, in the survival of our people, in the survival of all peoples on the world in general. Food sovereignty, food security, all these issues, climate change, none of them will be solved if we don't have a collective mind working along the same way. So what we did was, over this past winter especially, we've held several additional workshops of things I knew they really might not have good knowledge in terms of groundwater and water, things like that. So, you know, found a friend that knew that, and she volunteered her time to come down and do that kind of stuff. We had other ones on forestry, on Carolinian tree identification, which is vital to indigenous agriculture, like on a larger scale. And, you know, things like that. We got another one coming up soon on just plant, Carolinian plant identification. Things like, you know, the leeks and the fiddleheads and the ginger and all those kinds of things that should be in our forest and you should be able to go and gather, right? Just to make sure you know what it is you're looking at. You know, so those kinds of things.
But Brandt also says that the youth have to show they are dedicated, committed, and want to be part of the 3-year collective process, which is a give and take, I help you, you help me association. If someone doesn't show up to help one of the other youth farmers when asked, they will not be called next time. Brandt is a well-known speaker sharing climate-smart indigenous agriculture and food security, including at the 2022 Fifth World Congress on Agroforestry held in Quebec City. I'm David Moses.
And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, Andrew Dow, John Roon, David Moses, and Alexandra Fernandez. National editor Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Great to have you with us. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Until next week, ciao.
LJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.